What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that have come out this week.
We review them.
We do. You haven't been here for a little bit, Pete, so we're going to have to reassimilate you to this whole thing. First of all, comic books, they're like regular books, but they have like very funny pictures.
Yeah. Or they're like comic strips, but really stretched out.
You know what I mean? Really. Like, imagine if Hagar the Horrible was doing whatever he does, but over the course of 20 pages.
Yeah, Garfield's chasing like 50 lasagnas.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it's honestly the dream. And you can leave the dream too if you subscribe for ad-free versions of our podcast and all the podcasts we do at patreon.com/comicbookclub. We also have an active Discord. I'm mentioning a lot on our podcast because I mentioned it in a podcast the other day and somebody was like, you have a Discord? Even though I said it a bunch of times, I usually say it at the end of the podcast. I'm going to try setting
it up again.
Come hang out. Come hang out, yo.
I don't know what just happened.
I love that.
You almost turned into a cat.
Paula Deen impression?
Or something. I don't know. Why don't we move on and talk about the comic books? And I'm going to put a spoiler warning here for everything we're talking about. But we're going to kick it off with Absolute Green Arrow, number one from DC Comics, written by Pornsack Pichichot, art by Raphael Albuquerque. And we talked to the team behind this book a couple of days back. It is in the Comic Book Club feed, so you can check it out. Great chat with them. Really fascinating to talk to them about it. But they're not here, baby, so we can talk freely about this comic book. Cut loose. But I do want to hear from Pete, because I think Justin and I, we read it before, and we were like, this book is awesome to both of them. Pete, we haven't talked to you about it yet. What did you think about Absolute Green
Arrow? And let's remember that Pete has a grudge against Green Arrow for some sort of undisclosed reason from like over a year ago when Green Arrow
He betrayed his whole family, just walked
they
away
from him. They forgave him
And I do want to mention that's a different Green Arrow, but it was in the event Absolute Power, which sounds title-wise very similar to this.
That's nice. What I'm saying.
Well, when it comes to this, you had me at Kirky. I mean, the guy's art is unbelievable.
He had you at the last syllable of his name.
That's right. Actually the last. That's a very last late thing time
I said.
To have
I said several things before.
Well, you go on. You go on. But all you have to say is
you go on now.
You go on.
You talk a lot. But once you say that artist's name, I'm in. And I was very happy with this. The art, the style. I mean, I love a small start. You know, we start in a single drop of blood, you know, just setting the tone, setting the style. It has a cool noir feel to it. Love the action. This is kind of like, it felt like, you remember Mask of the Phantasm? It's like that, but what if that was Oliver Queen kind of feel to it? So,
interesting.
Yeah,
well,
I love.
Just to clarify a little bit about the continuity here, this takes place after the Absolute Evil special, where Oliver Queen in the Absolute Universe was murdered by a cabal of billionaires. So now in this book, we're getting a mysterious masked man killing those billionaires and other billionaires, basically a serial killer for billionaires, while Dinah Lance, who is a former MMA fighter, is forced to be a bodyguard for some of these billionaires and starts clashing with the serial killer. So that's where you get into this book. Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, so I thought it was awesome. I love the kind of like badass kind of look of Green Arrow here. He kind of got plussed up on his absolute to kind of take. So I thought that was cool and really kind of focused on like how smooth and badass he was. So I was enjoying all of that. And I think it was well executed through the art. So I'm excited, kind of had a fun reveal at the end. And so, yeah, I'm kind of excited to get more of this.
I think this is fantastic. I love this book. It's my favorite of the week. Great way to kick off the stack.
Yeah, great way, Alex. Nice job.
Really great.
Hey, no problem, guys. Anytime.
A lot of people have different ways they approach their stack. To put a banger at number one, bold. I got to say, Alex, bold. Yeah. Little risky.
This is the single. This is the radio single I'm putting up front.
Nice. Usually not the first track on an album, but
you want to build to the best one, yeah.
Or at least put it at number three.
No, you put it at number one because after that it starts getting too long. You're like, I don't know, what am I doing? I got to wash my dishes or something.
Yeah.
What?
Gen Z correspondent Alex Albert.
Yeah, what the hell?
Except for the dishes.
Scroll.
Yeah, I gotta scroll my dishes. What I was gonna say though is it's so dark. It gets dark immediately. Stays dark. When we were talking to the creative team on this, I was like, it's wild to me that this is a dark book set in a dark universe, and almost everything is ripped from the headlines of our lives. the stories about billionaires being absolute monsters. So like. That was funny, and really that part resonated with me a bit harder. I think the art in this is fantastic. It is very Raphael Albuquerque, but sort of much more horror-infused, mm-hmm. like darker. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we talked to them also, he was talking about, everyone's worried if I was going to, like, get in trouble with the censors, with the crossing the comics code line. And he was like, don't worry, I know how to deal with them. And he was able to draw this book and have it be just like fucked up, but not crossing the line into true depravity. So very cool.
Great book. Let's see if we got a twofer here with Ultimate Impact Reborn, number one from Marvel, written by Chris Condon, art by Stefano Caselli. We also talked to Chris Condon last week on the live show about this book. And this takes place, I asked him about the continuity of this because there's been a little confusion. This takes place directly after Ultimate Spider-Man Incursion, where Miles Morales comes back from the Ultimate Universe with a bunch of origin boxes, which are powers from the Ultimate Universe that should have gone to people but didn't. So, for example, in this book, you have Wonder Man's powers that didn't go to Simon Williams of the Ultimate Universe. Now they're in a box, and they end up with another guy who is going to become the new Wonder Man in the Marvel Universe, in addition to the previous Wonder Man. So that's kind of what's going on here, while we also meet a villain called Hostilicus, who is in the Negative Zone in the Ultimate Universe. Miles is trying to get the origin boxes across town to Tony Stark. Why Tony couldn't just come to him, who is to say. But basically,
doesn't do house calls.
Yeah, he's busy, we get the setup here of how these origin boxes end up in various places. Presumably, one of them, we see them sort of like pop out to a bunch of different places. One of them ends up, as we'll talk about later in the stack, in the events of Wolverine Weapons of Armageddon. But let's talk about this book. How'd you feel about this? I know, Justin, you're a big Condon fan. Were you con or pro?
Proden or Condon? I like this book. Chris Condon is a great writer. And I like that it did pick up quickly. This is sort of like a chase issue of this. And like, there's a lot of energy. We get the spot as a villain that that Miles Morales is fighting. I mean, my larger thoughts are like just trying to understand the Marvel superstructure here, because we have the origin boxes, which just from a look, they look like printers. They look like sort of Hewlett Packard printers. Uh-huh. And I'm like, oh, I wish they looked a little cooler. I guess once they open, we're not going to be chasing them anymore. But between this and what happens in the Wolverine book, I was like, can we have these look a little like... We had the Infinity Gems, the Infinity Stones, later renamed. I was like, those are awesome. And this, these are like Best Buy purchases that everyone's like, hold on to those. But in general, I also don't understand how the origin boxes feed into Armageddon. These feel like very different ideas. Origin boxes feel like something that is very comic booky. It feels like a 90s summer crossover, which is maybe what we're getting, where it's just like big idea, simple. People who don't have powers are getting powers. There's going to be conflict there. On the other hand, the road to Armageddon that's been being built up by Chip Zdarsky feels like very much like nations at war, bureaucracy, power, the sham of who holds power, multiple people sort of pretending to be something they're not, and militaristic like strategy. So like I don't see how these two ideas are going to be reconciled.
Well, there was a really good interview I was listening to with Chris Condon that I did last week, where he was talking about how this is kind of its own thing in a certain way, and a lot of what he's concerned about is what happens when power falls into the hands of either the right people or the wrong people? What does it do to them? And it doesn't necessarily make the right people do the right thing. It doesn't make the wrong people do the wrong thing. But he's really coming at it from a character direction. And I would say I agree with you wholeheartedly what you're saying, Justin, all jokes aside. But at the same time, This to me feels like the best example of connective fiber. We've been complaining a lot about like these very middle books. We're like, we're on the road. Armageddon's coming. Here's the road to Armageddon. We're still there. We just took a left on the road to Armageddon. Now we're on another road. Yeah. What do you know?
And this it's also is the road to Armageddon.
Yes.
And it's like Mass Ave.
Exactly. And this is that for sure. But the fact that Chris Condon like really takes the time to let us sit with all of these characters and get to know them in little vignettes before they get these powers, I thought worked really well for me. I was intrigued and interested by all of these guys, even though you could kind of like see the superstructure over it, just in terms of this issue, I liked what was going on.
Two things. One, Alex, I have your origin box, and I'm hoping one day you earn it. Secondly, Justin, you're
okay. I'm sorry. No, I have so many questions. So, is this my powers that you're keeping, or is this me from the Ultimate Universe? So you have my powers.
No, your powers. You haven't earned them yet. I keep waiting for you to do one.
Oh, okay. So I was supposed to be. So you're the maker in this scenario. You're keeping. Yeah.
Exactly. And Justin, I think you're misremembering. I remember opening up presents and being like, sick printer, bro. Oh, you got the Hewlett Packard. Oh, shit. This is the inkjet. You know, so I think maybe you've blocked that part out of how cool it is to get a printer. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Let's hook it up before breakfast so we can print stuff.
I am documents. Woo.
Line up the PDFs we like. Everyone pick your PDFs.
Oh, man. You like the colors on this pie chart? Anyways, I think this book is fun. I like the spot of kind of back and forth with Spider-Man here. I thought that was enjoyable. But then there's the creepy guy with blood on his face. You know what I mean? He seems pretty ominous. But, I don't know.
Are you talking about Hostilicus? I feel like his name is ominous as well.
Sure, sure, yeah.
Truly,
I think both his name matches the blood on the face. Yeah, I think, I wasn't as bothered maybe, but I thought the art was kind of fun, so it had a lightness to it, and I think the kind of energy of having Spot and Spider-Man go back and forth nicely reflected that.
Do you think he was given the name Hostilicus, or he took it for himself?
He seems like a taker.
Yeah. I think he was born. They were like, this is little baby Hostilicus.
Yeah. I mean, because that's really nature versus nurture. I think they really made Hostilicus.
Yeah, for sure. Why don't we talk about Odin, number one from Image Comics, written by Marguerite Bennett and Jamestown IV, art by Letizia Catanici. This is about a journalist who is investigating a group of neo-Nazis. They end up on a trip to the motherland together, not Germany, but Norway, because they believe the Norse gods are the purest blood. And things go supernaturally wrong by the end of the issue.
And this is a tie into the Matt Damon movie that's out, right?
What?
Or coming out
Odyssey?
Soon. Yeah.
Oh, nope.
I certainly hope not.
Different gods, different mythologies. Justin, I know you were a big fan of this or intrigued by this.
Yes, I did enjoy this. I mean, like, you rarely see a book that goes so wholehearted into, like, white power as the main driving force for the characters to come together. But I'll tell you what, it made me think, like, oh, why would they make so much of Nazi stuff and fascist and like true racism? They're chasing like the whitest experience. Like, they talk about that a lot in this book. So that was interesting to me. And I feel like, oh, I bet it's because they're going to kill everybody and we're going to feel good about when they kill them. So that's cool. I'm into that. I do like the undercover journalist aspect of this. I like the horror nature of it. It reminded me of, I'm forgetting the name, the Showtime show.
Weeds?
The soccer players. No, the soccer players.
Baby Hitler?
Nope, that's not a show.
Red Shoe Diaries.
That's it, the Red Shoe Diaries. Okay. I love David Duchovny's drift into softcore pornography.
I thought this was great. Letizia Catanici has been doing great stuff now and again on the Something is Killing the Children universe, and that translates exactly properly here, and it went in directions I was not quite expecting, really horrifying directions by the end of the issue. But like you said, it's going to be eminently satisfying to see these very surfacey Nazis get their due, and the characterization they put throughout here of really just like cutting the knees out from these guys immediately in terms of their beliefs, yeah. but then also drawing the line between these people who are playing at being Nazis for a variety of reasons and a real Nazi when he shows up. And it's really scary what he does.
Yeah, great gradation there. Yeah. Like, these people are just sort of losers who fell into this. And then you meet someone who's like, oh, this guy's going to be a much larger
this is going to be a problem.
yeah.
And Pete, Yellow Jackets, you like Nazis. Shit. What did you think about this book?
Yeah, it went a little too hard on the white supremacy for me. Like, I can understand, like, okay, hey, there's a villain.
Back off of my boys. Is that what you're saying, Pete?
Yeah. What? No.
Went too hard on the white supremacy. You wanted them to go lighter on the white supremacy.
No, I'm just saying, like,
take it easy on those guys.
You know, yeah, like,
they're trying.
You're showing us a evil villain origin story, but I was like, this is a little too in depth. It's making my skin crawl, and I just was like, man alive, we're going really hard on this. It just felt icky, but the art was really impressive.
Yeah,
I just couldn't get into the material. It was too racist for me.
New Titans, number 35 from DC Comics, written by Tate Bromble, art by Sammy Basri and Jordi Tarragona with Vicente Quifentes. This is the third part of the arc that has found the regular old Titans taken in by a evil half of Cyborg that is all machine. Cyborg Victor version has broken out on his own, and he has recruited a new team to disrupt the machine's programming language, which we get a real layout of why this team was put together and what they were brought in for by the end of this issue. So it wraps up this first arc and then tees up another arc to come and more mysteries to come. I'm going to throw a thought out to you that I had while I was reading this issue, which really should have occurred to me earlier, and I can't believe it didn't. This is basically Uncanny X-Men, right? Like, this is the original X-Men get captured by Krakoa, and Professor X has to send in a new team to get them out, and then they become the team going forward. But there's still mysteries and things that go on with Scott Summers, who is the cyborg in the situation. It seems like the same exact thing, and I don't say that as a knock. I say that as like, oh, I think they really cleverly riffed off a thing that people don't actually riff off of quite enough.
Well, and I do think that especially the first half of this book had real throwback comic book energy. It felt like an 80s or 90s comic with everyone like running around. It was a bit chaotic. And then in the second half, I feel like we got the emotional nuances that we really needed to give this weight. I really like the Nightwing Corey moment, which with Spoiler walking in being like, what's this? do I need to talk to Batgirl? And I was like, whoa, going hard right away. I love the use of Spoiler in this and the hype that she, the glow up that she
You're
gets
a sucker
from,
for Spoiler.
Love Spoiler. I love a Spoiler and I love Spoiler. And then I thought the sort of the win they had at the end here was really good in the conversation between Cyborg and himself.
Yeah, that was, to me, living the dream. Being able to kind of go back in time and play yourself in video games, I mean, that is just phenomenal.
That's Pete's dream.
You know what I mean?
What
like,
game,
that would be the coolest.
What game would you play, Pete?
Oh, I would go Tecmo Bowl or, you know what I mean?
Tecmo Bowl.
And would you beat yourself or would you go easy on yourself?
Well, that's the thing. Like, knowing what you know, would you be able to, win against a younger self? So
let me ask you a time travel question just to get even deeper into this, Pete. So I feel like I know the answer to this one, but when you lost to Tecmo Bowl, how did you feel when you were a little kid?
I mean, me and my brother fought about it all the time.
Right. So if you, older, came back and beat yourself, wouldn't that be awful? Wouldn't you be scarring yourself, which then those scars would last?
Yeah, but would you, though? Or would it be, where they be epic ties? You know what I mean? Like, could you even...
Ties?
Yeah.
Here's the thing. If you remember Tecmo Bowl, Pete, the best you are at that game is when you're playing it all the time. Like, you going back, you're too old. You will be
defeated. Dude, but I would train because I knew I was, you know what I mean? Like, you got to train.
You don't know you're going back in time.
You don't? You don't get any kind of heads up that you're going back in time? Come on.
No, it's like a quantum leap situation. So you get back there and you're like, oh boy.
Yeah, it would be an oh boy situation and you would get crushed. Because here's the thing.
That would be heartbreaking.
Your younger self would either be the Raiders with Bo Jackson or the Niners.
No, I was the Giants all day. No,
then you would definitely. You can't both be the Giants. So one of you would have to choose another team.
Well, yeah, then the other, you can both be the Giants.
No.
Yeah.
Literally, you can.
Yes, you can.
How often do the Giants play the Giants in reality? I'm just asking, because they try to mirror that in the game.
Yeah, yeah.
Couldn't they? How many players are actually on a football team? Like, are there enough? This is an honest question. Like, are there enough players on a football team to play themselves?
Yeah.
Yes, there are 53 players on a football team.
Oh, so they could.
Yes, definitely. Well, that's how they practice, is they play each other.
Right. But why don't they do that? Like, that would be an easy way to get to the Super Bowl. Like, you could win a game just by the Giants playing the Giants.
I'm just saying, dude.
It's not like a backyard, Alex. You don't just pick a team to play.
On NHL, dude, you can play, like, Sabres versus Sabres. We used to do that. You know what I mean? Like, you can...
We're talking about Tecmo Bowl.
Yeah, there's no rules.
You're out of your head saying you're in the game.
I do know this. In real life, there's no rules in hockey. Like, there's none. Like, they can do whatever they want at all points. I also know it's a very sexy sport from watching
TV. There are rules in hockey. Yeah. There's a lot of rules.
You're coming at sports from a very different angle.
There's all rivalry off campus.
Hey, you check it out off campus, dude?
Yeah. I've seen some clips.
He can't stomach it. He can't stomach that much sports.
Pete knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do.
Great. I think we've talked about New Titans enough. Why don't we move on and talk about Wolverine Weapons of Armageddon number 4 from Marvel.
Finally.
Chip Zdarsky, art by Luca Maresca. This one's pretty simple to understand. So Wolverine is teaming up with David Coulton, who is the Captain America of the late 2000s, who has a bit of a heart problem because he can't really...
Sort of the Limp Bizkit.
He has a beard now. He also has an Iron Man arc reactor heart, which we didn't know about until this issue. And they're trying to track down another mutant who has basically Wolverine adamantium, but all over his body. Meanwhile, in the middle, there's Nuke, who is a guy who is another takeoff on Captain America, but he's crazy and takes pills, and he's been cloned, and so there's large versions of him that are Pite Cyborg robot. They're all after this origin box that we mentioned earlier, which is also wanted by Prime Warrior, which created the Nuke clones. And of course, this is all leading directly to Armageddon in a very clear and sensible way.
Like all great comics, no explanation.
What's in the
box?
We're
not telling you.
Yeah, every comic is somebody's first, and maybe this comic is somebody's first.
What's in the box?
Their origin box,
I love comics. This is great.
That's the thing, is like, it's also funny, like this and the Ultimate Reborn issue. Like, there's, like, so many origin boxes that are just, like, loose, tumbling all over New York City. And here, there's one, and everyone's fighting over it. No, even the characters, they're like, I don't know what's inside that thing, but I really got to find out. I was like, what? Nobody knows. What are we talking about here? They're like, it has extra-dimensional energy. I was like, okay, guys.
That's why blind boxes are so popular, man.
Mm-hmm.
You think it's the blind bag, the comic version of blind bags? That's truth to that. That's right.
I mean, legit though, like, it's crazy that Marvel has not put out blind box origin boxes where you can get, like, not actual powers, but like, if I had Captain America's shield in there, or like Spidey's web shooters or something, that's $1 billion idea, Pete.
That's right.
I think actual powers would be better.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like that.
Alex.
Actually think about this comic book, though?
I mean, it's just like you said when you were introducing it, it's very confusing. And I don't know. This feels like a comic that is building up the Coulton Captain America, which is cool, like, interesting character, but feels so far away from the story, and a story that is convoluted with all these other characters that don't feel as important. Like, the Tyler character in this feels like a Wolverine protege, but like, that doesn't seem like what we're actually doing. Wolverine at the end is like, sorry, I gotta go. And I'm like, you gotta go? What about all these people that you were here? Your name's on the title, dude. You can't leave.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're kind of getting at is it feels like three different stories running at the same time that don't quite gel. You've got a Nuke story, you've got a Wolverine story, and you've got a Captain America story. And the Wolverine story is like the very straightforward one that we see it a million times, where there is another Wolverine and he has to be like, well, I was wild and then I became not wild. The other Wolverine's like, oh yeah, I could also not be wild. And we get that in there. But then there's like the David Coulton and Nuke story, which could be interesting on its own, but we don't spend enough time really with David Coulton to get to know him, even after that first arc of Captain America. The only thing I did like, and this is a big spoiler, but like they are forced into a situation where they need to give the power of the origin box, even though they don't know what it is, or we don't know what it is, to David Coulton. And the way they reveal that is David Coulton is alive, he's fine, and then he's like, okay, see you later, Wolverine, but he's floating. And I thought that was cool. That is a nice way of revealing that.
Yeah. It was. It was a great little end moment on this whole thing.
Plus, it feels good to give somebody a gift and they're so happy they float away. You know what I mean? So that's just
like a printer.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I would float
careful
away.
If you're ever at a kid's party, Pete. That's like the worst thing to have happen at a kid's party.
Speculation wise, which powers do you think he has? Because the other complicated part here, and I know we talked about this with Ultimate Impact Reborn, is he has powers of somebody from the Ultimate Universe who should have been a hero from the regular Marvel Universe, but never got those powers because the Maker stopped them. So, like, for example, in Ultimate Impact Reborn, like we were talking about, Wonder Man never got those powers. So this is somebody we have not seen in the Ultimate Universe, did not see their skeleton or the dead or evil or anything like that. And their powers were left over, and now David Coulton has them. So,
yeah, I mean, I had two thoughts right away. The first was Sentry.
Yeah,
the second,
100%. Yeah.
So, like, maybe that's just what it is. The second was Ms. Marvel.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, like,
Captain Marvel. Like,
Captain Marvel. So, like, I don't know if they would cross genders that way.
Cross the street.
We should just do that. Yeah. So, like, I don't know. I don't know what we're doing with that. Because, like, it's also weird, like you're saying, they're taking a negative from the Ultimate Universe and being like, look. Like, the idea that at the end of Reborn, Ultimate Reborn, they're like, hey, Wonder Man is the big reveal here. I'm like, Wonder Man? That's not a big reveal. It should be something else. But all the main characters already have powers in the Marvel, in the Ultimate Universe, because that was what the launch of the Ultimate Universe was.
Yeah. Well, lots going on, and we're continuing to walk that road to Armageddon. Let's talk about Of the Earth, number one, from Image Comics, written by Chris Condon and Andrew Eric, art by Charlie Adlard. Chris and I also talked about this one, and the thing that's kind of neat here, which he talks about a bit in the back matter, is Andrew Eric is a friend of his from back in the day who has wanted to break into screenwriting and for various reasons has not been able to, and so this is Chris Condon basically being like, here's your big break. Let's work together on this comic book with the guy from The Walking Dead. And so what we're getting here is an eco-horror story about a woman who is returning home. And things are not all right with the oil in the area, is the short way of putting it.
To me, it was kind of like a twisted Little Red Riding Hood where a girl's got to go see grandma's house. And, you know, will the big bad wolf let her go? You know what I mean? So... but I love the art in this and the tension, and not sure what's going on yet, but I think they're setting up something exciting.
Yeah, I thought this was great. I really like, there's such a great care given to setting up the story. We get some nice text pages to put us in the right headspace. And then it builds up from, like, starting with text pages, giving us some history, getting closer to a horrifying image to go out on, which I really like that build. This seems really fun. Very excited to read this.
Me too. Basket of cash, you know?
Basket of cash. Seven Wives, number one from IDW, written by Zoe Tunnell, art by V. Gagnon. This is the kickoff of the new IDW crime line. And the thing here is that they're doing three oversized issues per title. So you're getting... I think, what was it, 48 pages, something like that. I think the next two issues are like 40 pages, but still, that's bigger than usual. The actual concept, though, is that a cult leader is killed, and any one of his seven wives may be the culprit, possibly somebody else, but let's be honest, probably one of the wives. What'd you guys say?
I mean, it's what you call him a cult leader. He's sort of like an old-school Mormon.
Sure.
It's part of the LDS.
Right? Oh, right. Church of Latter-day Saints. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, it's not... I guess you could call it a cult, but it is, like, something that happens in the world.
Right.
Pretty common.
Yes. I think there's a whole TV show called Sister Wives or something like that. So there
Sister Wives, Big Love, which is another show that... not to keep plugging old Showtime shows, but another show about... a Mormon with multiple
wives. Yeah, so this is like Big Love, but with murder.
Ooh. And cool. I think this works. Like this also was very meticulous about really getting us into the lives of these different wives. We get to hear a lot from them, all the different series of fucked up things that they have going on. I love how frustrated the cops are in this. They're so frustrated. They're like, this case sucks. Let's go get blind drunk at the bar. And I was like, oh, wow. It's hard out here for law enforcement. And then the twist at the end that I will say I did see coming, but still enjoyed.
Yeah, this was tough for me. You kind of lost me at the title. It's one of those things where I don't care about a dude who has seven wives because it's like, all right, am I rooting for the wives to kill him? Or like what, you know, who's side am I on?
I don't think you're rooting for the dude.
Yeah, I'm definitely not like rooting for the dirt. Yeah, so I don't know. It's a situation that I don't have a lot of knowledge of or why someone would do that or whatever. So, yeah.
What would be the maximum number of wives you'd want to have, Pete?
I don't think I could do more than one. You know?
Two?
Not two?
That's definitely more than one, guys. Nice job.
Well, but nice it's job. Weird because Alex and I are both setting you up with a potential fiancés, and we really want both.
Oh, wow. That's a fun show.
But they don't know about each other. They don't know.
Yeah. And so
I got to do a missed outfire situation.
Yeah, we set you up at the same restaurant on the same night. What are we going to do?
Oh, man.
Yes. And so we need you to, for one of them to be your charming Pete, but another one you have to dress up like a middle-aged British housekeeper.
Oh, wow.
Is that possible?
Because that's what she's into. That's what she's into.
And I know you like the movie. I did just watch the first half of Mrs. Doubtfire with my kids like 2 days ago. That movie's so crazy. It's still good.
Come on,
but
course.
It's so crazy how they walk you into it.
Come on. Yeah. It's great.
It works. It
great
works.
Stuff. Seven Wives, be as good as Mrs. Doubtfire. I think that's what we're saying.
I think we're saying this is the Mrs. Doubtfire of horror-based crime LDS comic book.
Yep. Superman Unlimited, number 13 from DC Comics, written by Dan Slott, art by Lucas Meyer. The main thing that's going on here is there are two John Kents. One of them is the younger version of John Kent, who ostensibly has been ripped from his prison in a volcano where he was kept for years, except he was taken out early thanks to some shenanigans from an otherworldly being, is the simplest way of putting it. Meanwhile, the regular older John Kent is now calling himself Tomorrow Man and not revealing himself because he wants to give his younger version a chance to assimilate to the modern world. Unfortunately, he's harboring a lot of rage issues, and not helping it is a superpowered Beppo, a kryptonite-infused monkey who is going wild on Metropolis. What did you guys think about this issue?
Well, and a very damaged Bibbo.
Yes, Bibbo is doing bad. Bibbo do bad.
I think this is a perfect thing for Dan Slott because this is kind of, you know, once you add monkeys, there's a silliness to it. And that guy does great work with the kind of absurd stuff. So I feel like this is a good person for this idea.
There's a lot going on in this.
Sure is.
And I mean, I like a lot of the elements of it, but I guess I just want a little bit of time to process some of this. Cause I was like, spoiler for what happens, but like Bibbo gets shot. I'm like, is Bibbo dying?
Wow.
Beppo's going crazy.
Yeah.
Then we have the dueling John Kents. Lois Lane is sort of like, what's happening? And I was like, I sort of feel a little bit like you, Lois.
Oh, she knows. I feel like the way that Dan is writing her, she knows that it's John is the Tomorrow Man.
Yes, 100%. She's like, interesting. You seem to know a lot about how I should be parenting this child, which I thought was, yes, good. Like, that's what I'm saying. There's a lot of good stuff here, but I just want to sort of smooth out the story a little bit, perhaps.
We shall see. Next up, Venom 258 from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Carlos Gomez. Dealing with the fallout of the Death Spiral crossover, we are at the funeral of Paul. And a bunch of stuff comes out of the conversations and this issues. As Peter and Mary Jane walk through Central Park and they talk, later on, Peter talks to Venom, and we get a new status quo for Venom and Mary Jane by the end here. How are you guys doing? Are you okay?
I've never seen a couple start a date at another, at an ex's funeral.
Yeah, that's
and that's what happens here. I've never seen it's Paul like, hey, has been so disrespectful. He goes,
maybe it's too early. Maybe we'll give it a couple of weeks, but, you know, do you want to? She's like, oh, let's do it right now.
No. Yeah. This was not clear, but I think there's a time dash there.
There is a time dash there, but the date is set up. It cuts from them in their funeral clothes to them in regular clothes, walking along out of it. I was like, Mary Jane did not seem at all upset about Paul's death in any way. I was
I did like his tombstone. I'm forgetting what it says, but it was like, the essentially being like, Paul Rabin, dead forever, never coming back.
Good.
Rot in hell, Paul. Very sad.
It was sort of sad. But the top knot, I think the top knot's going to sprout up from the ground.
Do you think they should have buried him face down so his top knot could be sticking out of the grave?
Face down, not up. That's the way I like to die.
Oh, my God.
I thought this was great. I thought this was a wonderful conversation-focused issue. There's a lot of nuanced character stuff that's going on here as Peter and MJ talk. I think Al Ewing did a nice job of threading the needle where he's not getting them back together. He's understanding that there is a love there. They both know that maybe they will get back together someday, but right now they're on different paths and going in different directions. And I love the Venom-MJ relationship as well. I think it's really well done. The only bummer, which they had already revealed in solicits and everything, but the new costume design, I liked having the jacked Venom over Mary Jane. I thought that was kind of fun. Like, I understand.
I agree with you.
I understand why they go in the direction they did with the Boris Felt costume with the red hair sticking out, but I don't know.
I agree with you. I sort of will miss the larger, but maybe we'll get that. What I like about it is it really reinforced the duality of the character, where Mary Jane would step out and be like, hey, stop it or whatever.
Yeah.
And in this, it's going to be a little bit, I think, it was a nice visual way to show that. The only thing I would say about this is I wanted them to leave the door open a little bit more for either a Peter MJ relationship starting.
Thank you.
A spark there.
Yeah.
Because it feels like we get there, and I really liked the digestion they went through of what happened in the past and really talking about like what Mary Jane was going through in her trip to the sideways dimension and all that. That was great. But they go so hard to say like, we're friends. Friends are good. It's important to have friends. And Jesus, that's what we are. Christ. I was like, okay.
The other thing they did
is they dismissed the Flash Thompson flirtation as well in this. And I was like, so well, give me one. Give me one of these things.
Also, why we're recapping everything that happened? What the fuck happened with Mephisto, and what did you whisper to him? Like, what the fuck? I just, this was really heartbreaking.
Do we still not know that?
Yeah. Huh. Also, the fact that, like, the friend zone kind of talk after a long date was just brutal. You know what I mean? Just absolutely brutal to kind of live through this comic for that conversation. It was rough.
Can you imagine having a nice day and end with just talking about being friends? Yeah. There's no way any of us have experienced that. Right?
Surely not. Could you imagine a nice date where it ends with you talking to your girlfriend's clothes that you used to wear?
Great point.
Yeah,
that's what happens. Like, hey, MJ, give me a second with your clothes.
Give me a second. I got to talk to your clothes.
Before this day ends, I just need
my clothes.
Yeah,
I got to yell at them, and then the clothes yells at you. That's crazy.
Yeah,
you ever have to break up with clothes?
All the time, man. All the time. Yeah.
It's over between us, pants.
I agree with you, Justin. Give us a little hope. The friend speech is a brutal in real life. I don't need that in my comics.
Yeah, it's all right. I think in this book, I'm fine with Peter Parker being totally to the side and not involved, because I really like Mary Jane in this book. I really like Mary Jane with Venom. I like the cast that she's been building up. I'm going to miss Paul, honestly, more than Mary Jane, I guess.
And I hope this was like a Marvel office decision, because they're like, well, we can't have them together in this book because they're going to be together in other books. You know, that's what I'm hoping for.
Definitely not. That's not how it works.
No, it's not. I'm going to be mean for a second. It's crazy how delusional people are very specifically about this relationship. And I say this because there was a big management change at Marvel this week, like a huge one, where Dan Buckley, who's been there for 30 years, is now leaving the company next year and being, they're sort of like reshuffling the whole management structure. And the main reaction I saw to that was like, well, I hope the new guys coming in can get MJ and Peter back together.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like,
yeah, oh, okay, that's the first order of business. First day in the office.
Better be.
What are we doing about this relationship, guys?
Really struggling with that. Yeah,
I would be
guy
amazing.
Who used to work at Disney Music and manages the music division. All he's been thinking about is how we get MJ and Peter back.
Love
together.
Songs, maybe come the on, right jam to bring them back together.
Let me throw out the
thing. The prevailing logic online is that MJ whispered, "You'll make me remember everything." Which I do remember talking about and thinking about. But
okay, so she knows. She knows about the.
I think so. And I feel like
Peter doesn't know.
No.
She told him to do that.
Right.
So that's why I know you're mad about it, but it was sort of her idea to bring back
it. It was her
character,
idea.
A character who is just only disappointed with Peter lately. As we'll talk about in the Amazing Spider-Man book.
Yes. Why don't we move on, though, and talk about the Rockefellers, number 0 from Ghost Machine and Image Comics, written by Peter J. Tomasi, art by Francis Manapul. Now, we haven't talked about this title in a while, but they're kicking off a new event called The Unbelievables that is going to connect everything in this part of the Ghost Machine universe or collected into an Unbelievables universe, including Rockefellers, Hornsby, and Halo. And they're going to introduce a new title. Is it the Trillionaire Kid or something like that? Whatever it is. There's a couple of others they're teeing up in the back here. So I thought it was worth checking back in with this title. Justin, I know you were a big fan of it when it came out. How did you feel about this issue?
I really like this issue. And I will say I haven't been following this up. It's good. This is a good show. This is a good comic. I think the art's fantastic. I do like the characters. It was a little like the first third of it. I was sort of like, wait, what exactly is happening here? But once we get in there, like it's really fun. There's a core of regret here when it comes to the mother/grandmother, the loss of her.
Yeah, I agree. I thought this was a fun family adventure here. Some really amazing art, and that VW was sick.
Yeah, I generally thought this did a better job of introducing it. What is going on here? Better job of introducing it than the first issue did, I think. Like, one of my issues with the first issue was that they kind of go back in time and then they're just there. Here we get more of the future stuff that they are bringing with them. They're essentially like the Jetsons travel back in time, but danger. We get more of that here. Like, I thought there was more texture down the road, so I'm intrigued to see where this goes. Young Hellboy, thrilling sky adventures, number 1 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Mike Mignola and Thomas Snegowski, art by Craig Russo. The idea of this book is that young Hellboy is reading his favorite comic. So not only do we get young Hellboy, but we get the comic in the comic at the same time.
Whoa.
Featuring the thrilling sky adventures. Pete, is this, are you saying, oh my, for this sky guy?
Yeah, the Sky Devil is fun. I love the kind of like 50s feel and coloring to the art, the kind of cool mood to the comic for the older stuff. I think this is fun. I love a good Smitty. And I like the tone of this. So I had a blast. And I thought Sky Devil was a cool character.
What do you say you love a good Smitty? What do you mean? You like
a good sidekick. You know what I mean? Like Foggy is a good Smitty. You know what I mean?
Foggy's a good Smitty. Okay.
Yeah,
good.
That dependable person you need to go on adventures. Yeah. You know what I mean? You need a Smitty. You need a Foggy. You need, you know.
So, sorry. Is Foggy a Smitty or is Smitty a Foggy?
Well, I mean, I don't have that kind of power. You know what I mean? I mean, Jesus, power. I didn't go to Cornell. I can't break it down.
Oh, okay. I went to Cornell, so I could determine what is a Smitty and what is a Foggy.
Yeah, I mean, let's see it, Smarty Pants. Break it down. But great. I, a mere human, I can't.
Well, Foggy
do that
clearly
kind of
is a subdivision of something else that makes a lot of sense to me. So I would say Foggy is a Smitty.
What a sad fact.
He has no identity all on his own. He is just...
Foggy's below Smitty, a character that you just met in this random...
It's brutal. It's a brutal take.
It was your take.
You said it.
You said it.
I did not.
You said it.
This is
what you signed up for. I think they do a nice job with these young Hellboy comics, and the Sky Adventures are pulpy, fun throwback comics as well. So good stuff.
Let me ask you, though. Young Hellboy, how much is he just reading along with us for this?
It's like we're side by side. We're both like on the floor eating candy with young Hellboy, reading our comic books, sipping a soda.
A little bit of
mom comes in and we're like, you kids want some carrots?
Little bit of
got
false
a big
advertising.
Tray of carrots.
Your mom calling would... this a young Hellboy comic is not quite accurate. He's saying hi at the beginning before we hear in a whole other story. And unless he shows up at some point in this, which timeline wise, I don't think he can, it doesn't really.
It's him presenting it. It's him presenting it.
Is your mom Bugs Bunny? Who prepares a tray of carrots?
My mom is Bugs Bunny and my dad is Yosemite Sam.
Oh, I'm so glad they got together.
they put aside their beef and had little old me. Wonder Woman number 33 from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Danielle Sam Perry. We're continuing the Wonder War storyline where Wonder Woman is going up against the matriarch who has ruined the entire world. In this issue, she's reunited with Steve Trevor. And she, Steve, and Trinity are headed to the underworld to do something with the Fates, specifically to convince them to reverse this terrible timeline. Now, I'm going to say something that might be a little bit of a spoiler in a second, but first I want to talk about this book.
Well, let me say, this cover is amazing.
Yeah.
It's like just cool absolutely cover, man. Sick. Where we see villain and hero matched together in the reflection of a play. Just very cool. But I continue to enjoy this. I'm curious what Alex's issue is. But Tom King's been building toward this, everything feels so deliberate and controlled. I love the Fates being part of this at the end. It's just really enjoying this top to bottom.
Yeah, I agree. This is very badass. Wonder Woman's fucking shit up. The fight with the River Styx guy was intense. That was kind of crazy.
Charon?
Did not see that coming.
I don't know if that was intense. That was funny because Steve Trevor is like, hey, can we put aside our differences? And then Charon just clocks him with his little bone hand, which...
I didn't know Charon was such a, like... a sucker puncher. Mm-hmm. I was like, hey, man, use the scythe.
But fun last panel. I like... this continues to be great and a cool story and fun to see kind of Wonder Woman in this world kicking butt.
Is your question about Superman, Alex?
It's not even a question.
It's about dogs?
I got to say, like, I love this issue. And one of the things that I really love about this issue is we spent so much time building up the matriarch as this unstoppable badass. So once she realizes what Wonder Woman has done, the way that Danielle Sampera draws her is with the first unsteady shock we've seen her since the character was introduced. And I thought that was so well done. That gives you a moment of being like, oh, Wonder Woman is going to win, which of course she is. Of course she's going to do it. But like, that's a very, it's a thrilling feeling when you're watching it. The thing that I'm wondering about is when we talked to Tom King, he said something that's really stuck with me in this arc, which he said that he told us that he had worked for Chris Claremont at the beginning of his career. And he was like, so of course I wrote this as Days of Future Past, which I guess I didn't even realize, but I love Chris Claremont so much. So of course I'm always just writing his stuff. There's definitely like the apocalyptic future of Days of Future Past. But the main thing about Days of Future Past is they travel back to the past to try to stop it. Like, that's what the actual story of the thing. This issue, she goes to the Fates and she's like, you got to reverse it. And I haven't read Head Headed by Solicits. I don't know how long this arc is going to go or anything like that. But that stuck with me because I'm like, is that what he's doing here? Is he showing us like multiple issues of the future is destroyed so that Trinity or Wonder Woman gets sent back to the past to try to stop it before it happens?
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like we're going to get that. You don't think we're going to get that?
No, no, I think we are going to get that. This was not a question. This is just like, I haven't seen anybody discussing this online, and Tom King told us a thing, and I've been thinking about it while I've been reading this, and it just sort of like snapped in towards the end of the issue of like, oh, she's going to have the Fates send her back to stop this thing, or more likely send Trinity back, where Trinity, who has already been time traveling, is back there and then maybe trapped in the past, so we get Trinity in the present continuity of the DC universe.
Yes, I agree with you there. But yeah, I agree with you about the Days of Future Past reference. But I mean, he's not going to do a direct homage by any means. I think this is his version of like, oh, I didn't realize I was sort of ripping that off, is him being like, yeah, I vaguely encounter those ideas over the course of telling a much different. Also, I think you could see all the different people being killed, I think, is the other direct reference to that, sure. which has been a big part of the story so far.
I thought maybe it would be like a Days of Thunder thing where, you know, Wonder Woman wanted to go back in time, but they're all having ice cream, you know?
Oh, what?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, what? I know what you're, I know the movie you're referencing, but cool. Why reference that?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I don't understand why you would ever say any of those things. You know what I mean?
It's real, real foggy thing to do. And remember, Foggy is a sub-Smitty.
Yeah, I would say be more Smitty than Foggy. And let me just say, Pete, what I just said about not knowing what you're talking about, that applies to this conversation, but honestly, most of them. Also.
Fantastic Four, number 11 from Marvel, written by Ryan North and Stan Sakai. Art by Pat Booten and Stan Sakai. The front story has the Fantastic Four trying to figure out what to do about the new Future Foundation while they're fighting a new mechanical monstrosity. And then there's a backup story from Stan Sakai showing the FF fighting the Mole Man.
Yeah, come on.
Pete, you want to talk about this one first? Because Stan's your guy. Stan Sakai.
Yeah, the backup. The backup was just phenomenal. It was such a cool, fun Mole Man battle. So, yeah, I really enjoyed that. Also, love the Ben and Alicia stuff that we got in this issue. Really touching and very sweet. But, yeah, I love the energy the backup had. Was a lot of fun and really kind of felt like a cool old school story.
Another great use of a printer here when Ben Grimm prints out his plan in Braille for Alicia to read.
Yeah.
Do you use an origin box, maybe?
Maybe. Yeah, what is a printer but an origin box for, like, your term paper?
Yeah, the maker knew that if you could print things out, you could print leaflets that could take him down, so he destroyed all Hewlett-Packard in the Ultimate Universe. But Iron Lad saved them in some origin boxes.
Yeah.
Smart.
His mainframe, his software is Hewlett-Packard software. That's why it's absolute dog shit. Slam. Take that home, HP. Take that home, HP. Wow.
You know what isn't absolute dog shit is this issue of Fantastic Four, which is another great issue. There's some really fun stuff in here throughout, bringing back a very much forgotten villain in a very fun way. It also got really, like you were saying, Pete, very poignant towards the end. I got choked up a little bit with all the stuff with Alicia, the thing. I thought it was really sweet.
Yeah.
And all the things that they had to say about the future, I thought that was really nicely done. And it is just so interesting seeing Stan Sakai's very specific takes on the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, I agree with you on both sides of this. Stan Sakai stuff. Oh, Pete's leaving because he has to go deal with some Stan Sakai feelings right now. It was cool. And I liked that it was sort of like a very boilerplate story for him to just come in on and do the backup, which was nice. Felt like a real statement for him on Fantastic Four. And yes, I agree. Nice emotional story. Getting, you know, it was a real fallout issue from the Invincible Woman stuff, which I do think was cool. Wild how they're keeping her just hanging around in Baxter.
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of good. Like, rather than killing a villain or getting rid of her, she is in the background and she is something that they could bring back at a later point for whatever reason.
Certainly.
Death Fight Forever, number 4 from Image Comics, written by Andrew McLean, art by Alexis Zirit, Al Gaffa, Sam McKenzie, and Erwin Pampa. Like we talked about with every issue of this, this is a riff on Double Dragon meets He-Man meets G.I. Joe meets just like snorting a bunch of pixie sticks and getting greasy pizza all over your hands while you're playing Mortal Kombat at the pizza place.
Come on!
That's what this comic is.
Yeah, a sick cover, too. Yeah, I agree with all of that. This has just got fun 80s vibes to it. The start where he kind of says press start, just nostalgic. It brings you back. The action, the punching, you know. Yeah, some beer drinking going on here, plus a sick backup with Headlopper, which also has a lot of beer drinking. So very pro-beer in this issue, but I think this is a blast.
I will say it's not a backup. It's a preview of the Headlopper comic that we already talked about, but it's okay. Still excellent. Because I was, if I had heard about a backup being in this comic, I would rush out and pick it up. I don't want anyone to be disappointed with what you're getting here. But yes, this is fun. I really like the starkness of a lot of the sort of priest character that shows up here that they do battle with. But this feels like an absolute just jam session on Pete's, what exists in Pete's poster laden wall, high school wall.
Yep. Absolute Flash, number 15 from DC Comics, written by Jeff Lemire, art by Nick Robles. In this issue, Absolute Flash is continuing to deal with some time travel madness, specifically himself coming back from the future to warn him about something, possibly in a dream state. We're getting more mythology about how this version of the Flash's powers work. I know we've been like a little back and forth about this book, though probably more on the positive end the past couple of issues. What did you think about this one?
Well, this is cool. I kind of had an interesting idea where I felt like this, they kind of brought up this kind of wormhole, the thing that we saw here, and I wondered if they were kind of going to go with a Flashpoint idea, trying to tie in the Absolute Universe just kind of being a Flashpoint thing. But, yeah, this is interesting. Great art, as always. Yeah, they do cool stuff in this Absolute Flash, so I feel like they're continuing to do so.
The Rogue stuff is very interesting. I like the way they've played them, that they are just like, they're on the run together as a cool way to do that, all of that. And I like that this is already looping. This is all about time travel. There's a darkness. We're getting all these different, very Flash-y ideas, but they're being combined in a way that I think works and simplifies the Flash just what the Flash can be in the Absolute Universe.
And the costume, cool. I just want to say, is very cool. Like, I know it's been the same costume all these issues, but just looking at this cover right now, I'm like, that is a really good, very different riff on the Flash costume. It's very neat. So yeah, this feels to me like a key book going into, we know there's going to be an Absolute Universe crossover thing that's going to happen later this year, written by Jason Aaron. We don't know any more about it, really, but there's a lot of dark side stuff in here, so this feels very much like a key book to whatever the super story they're telling going forward.
Yeah, and the launch of a comic we just previewed called Absolute Dog Shit.
It's the real Smitty of comic books.
Come on, man.
X-Men United, number 3 from Marvel, written by Evel Ewing, art by Tiago Palma. This is about Emma Frost setting up a school of the mind that could bring all the X-Men together. So, of course, in this issue, several of them are in a quantum space created by a new character that we've never met before who seems to have some sort of shield hands who Captain America may or may not have known back in the day. He's hired them to kind of find this guy, but it turns out it's not that guy. It's another guy.
This comic is wild. Like, it's so far afield from a, like, X-Men mind hangout. They dip out and they're in a multi-state of reality where people are blinking in and out of like this liminal space before, with featuring Captain America as like the main driver of it. Like, it just feels so far afield, but like, I like these characters coming together. I think Jitter is really well done here. Mm-hmm. That's an X-Men I really like. The Laura Wolverine is great here. Like, I like all this, and it's crazy being like, next issue, and it's something wildly different. It's a catch-all book, but maybe that's what we need.
Yeah, there's some real touching stuff in here, which is nice. I like when X-Men gets kind of into some more like heartbreaking stories and stuff. So I thought this was cool, great art, you know, especially with the flashback stuff. The different kind of tone and coloring they use there was pretty neat.
Let me read the next issue, what's please. Coming in the next issue, so you can see maybe the chaotic tone here. Gray Matter Lane is totally safe from all interlopers, all threats, psionic, military, or demonic, right? Right. But what about the doubts and fears that always emerge among friends and lovers? And who keeps blowing up Emma's phone? Meanwhile, Iceman has a rather unorthodox training idea. Bring your 20-sided die. So, in the next issue, we're getting three disparate ideas. This is like watching an improv show.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that. I'm fighting my expectations maybe a little bit because I love the first issue of this book. I thought it was so good. And like we talked about, it was so nice to get back to basics like, oh, they're in a school. That's it. That's the whole thing. And immediately they swerved away from it in issue two and issue three. So I am hoping, based on what you're talking about, that we're getting back to like, okay, you get the concept of the mind school. Let's find out about the mind school because that's interesting. And I want to know more about that. So this swerve was very weird to me that it happened so earlier on and that it didn't tie into the school concept at all. Like there was no, let's go on a field trip or anything like that. So I don't know. Maybe that's not what this book is. Maybe it is not a school book and I just got to get over it.
Maybe it's an X-Men catch-all at a time when, like, we're not getting that. And that's nice. I feel like the X-Men universe does this every now and again. And it used to be X-Men Unlimited and other books like that. But this is cool.
Yeah, maybe it's a catch-all that's unlimited.
Yeah. Narco, number three from Image Comics, written by Doug Wagner, art by Daniel Hilliard. This is about a guy with narcolepsy who has been accused of murder, except he's been cleared of the murder. And this issue, he is trying to find out more of it with the world's friendliest cop. Like, legitimately, there's a cop character in here who constantly is like, oh, my bad, dude. Whatever you want to do, I'm up for it. Let's go. And it's crazy.
It is crazy. I feel like we're going to get another shoe dropping on that. I feel like it's like a good cop, bad cop situation. And he's taking good cop to the point where he's like, all right, man, I can't be more good to you. And it's going to twist that way, was my thought. But in general, I think this comic is creating just a great amount of dread that I'm really enjoying.
Yeah, gray art, crazy twists and turns, you know, the who did it, who do you trust type of thing is enjoyable. But again, I think the art is very cool.
I will bring up my
narcolepsy.
My complaint from the last issue, which had no falling asleep. There is falling asleep this issue, but I wish they were playing with it a little bit more. Because most of the time he like falls asleep because he gets stretched out and then he wakes up. And that's it. Yeah. Like there's no time dash. Nothing really happens when he's falling asleep or anything.
That's how it works, though. When you fall asleep, you wake
up. Have you ever fallen asleep, Alex?
No, not yet. But I'm excited to try it out at some point.
You're due. Look into it. Sleep.
Yeah. You space worms don't know what you're talking about.
Well, there is a moment in here where he falls asleep and wakes up, and his friend is holding a knife.
Sure. Yes. Yes. That's very true. All right. More of that,
but I will say, I think we are. I bet the climax of this is a real fall asleep, wake up nightmare situation.
But the fall asleep, wake up, and then got a knife, and then he's like, "I'm just making my friend breakfast." I was like, "What has blood on it, bro? What are you cutting?
What is he making?
What kind of breakfast? That better be hot sauce on there.
Hot sauce. I thought it was like strawberry jam or something like that, but."
You guys ever had scrambled blood? Blood over easy?
I love a little poached blood.
Hard to get that right.
It sure is.
I put it on my waffles. Batwoman, excuse me.
Alex.
I guess Bats can be women now. I don't know. It's 2026.
Check your privilege.
Sorry. We're feminist allies here. Batwoman, I guess, number three from DC Comics.
Don't say I guess.
I mean, I don't know.
Wonder Woman, I've never heard of this before.
Written by Greg Rucka, art by Danny. In this issue, Batwoman is continuing to deal with some sort of psychosis that hasn't quite been explained, as far as I'm aware. Her father's trying to help her, maybe, maybe not. He's always on the side of weirdness more than anything. And the question enters to try to talk to Batwoman as well. I know this is Pete's usual thing, but I love this cover. Like, this is my favorite cover of the week. There's something so fascinating about it because you get Batwoman and Question forehead to forehead, but I have never seen anybody draw the question with sort of like lightly defined eyes.
Yeah.
And it's, there's something about it that I find very entrancing, and I don't know exactly what it is.
Well, I would throw that out, like, agree with you on the cover, and then the art inside the book as well has the same, like, entrancing quality. It really, it's one of the few times when I'm like, man, this feels like the place where this comic is set. It feels very, like, European. It takes me there. Yeah. But some panels in there, I was like, oh, this one's a little sketchy and strange. But others, I'm like, oh, this is beautiful and perfect. So, and maybe that's the point. Maybe that's mirroring the psychosis that you're talking about, Alex, because it does feel like she's in sort of institutionalized, I think, in this. And her father's visiting her. She doesn't want to see him. The psychologist is talking to both of them and cautioning her not to go out. And seems like the psychologist is the villain. But I think the psychologist is trying to protect her from all this bad stuff that's happening and whatever she's going through.
I also have cool cover in my notes. The Batwoman stuff is really awesome at the end. The art and tone of it really is cool. I'm liking the fun twists and turns. I really love the kind of last panel reveal. Also love the kind of like not talking, just letting the art and action kind of panels happen. That ending got me pumped for more. I'm enjoying this.
I love it bringing the question into this. Like, their relationship has been was a major part of the earlier run that I really love. So finally to see it here. And the surprising thing that happened was cool.
Do you question the question's relationship?
There's a question in the air.
Oh. The Amazing Spider-Man, number 29 from Marvel, written by Joe Kelly, art by Pete Woods. In this issue, Spider-Man is still swinging around and trying to get caught up after being off Earth, and he can't, as usual, quite balance everything, leading to the introduction of a new villain that we known has been a long time coming. It is his friend who he works with that he knew from middle school, who has been infected with some sort of spores and will become a new villain, probably called Spore, based on the cover. And that gets introduced towards the end of the issue. Justin,
crazy, I put that together.
I know you've been a big fan of Amazing Spider-Man. Does that keep up with this issue?
Continues to impress. Like Spore, Justin, as a villain.
How dare you, man? You work in the industry. Nobody tips good in this issue. Did you notice that? Nobody.
I did.
Everybody shorts them on the tip. You are someone who's worked in the industry, knows how hard you work for that money. That's fucking bullshit. Why aren't you standing up, bro?
That's why I was going to say I'm rooting for Spore. Peter under tips. He was in the booth for too long. He had just had a bunch of coffee. $2 tip? I don't think so.
Yeah, that's
get him.
Garbage.
I think this is continues to be great. We're continuing to bring in the elements. Peter's girlfriend from space. I really love that character. He's in a booth and he's calling everyone he knows to try to get them to come. He even calls Shay.
That was funny. Shay. Yeah, he texts Shay and it was like read one day ago or something like that.
Shay not showing up. Very funny. Good work, Joe. And then the Spore as a villain, I think, is excellent. Like, really horror infused this issue in a good way. I said this earlier, but like the way that Aunt May treats Peter is like she's nasty. She hates him.
Well, her new boyfriend, husband, whatever.
She's got two boyfriends hanging around.
No. That second boyfriend is not her boyfriend. That is, we haven't really talked about this. This is the cousin that they introduced at the end of Death Spiral. We know, or I don't know if you guys know, but we know thanks to the solicits that, Joe talked about this, I think, that like the, when he was on the show, that the, what he calls is like the most shocking thing, they're calling it the most shocking thing in Spider-Man history. He was like, it actually is a really big event is coming up. And the general suspicion is this cousin is either Uncle Ben and Aunt May's son, or it's Richard Parker and Aunt May's son, or there's going to be like some sort of thing there with that guy where he's not actually a cousin. He's maybe a half brother or something like that.
I agree. The way it's talked about here, Peter mentions it and then we get that moment with Aunt May. So like there's definitely something exciting happening there. So that's cool.
And fun Daredevil and Spidey training montage. That was kind of cool.
That was cool. That was very
Everything's
fun.
Well done.
Good.
And a little comic. Shout out to the Punisher. That was fun.
Invincible Universe Battle Beast, number 9 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Robert Kirkman, art by Ryan Otley. In this issue, Battle Beast finishes off his battle with the Colossus and the other one that I'm blanking on the name of, who are plaguing this planet. Our prince, who has a weird curly penis, is rebuilding his planet. And by the end of this issue, not too much of a spoiler since it's on the cover for the next issue and I think one of the variant covers here, Conquest shows up. To potentially, as teased in the next issue, take on Battle Beast in an eating contest. Maybe this book is silly.
Yeah, it's great in all the right ways. This is really fun. Cool cover. It's nice to see Battle Beast living his best life, you know? Not everybody gets to do it, so just to see him so happy, and then, you know, just when he thinks like, oh man, I'm out of people to murder, and... what am I going to do next? Conquest shows up, and he's very excited to fight him. So I just think this is kind of silly, great fun, and it's a nice showcase for Battle Beast. You know, I'm enjoying these. I think this is a blast.
Yeah, there's some stuff. We're definitely into a lot of, like, characters that we aren't really going to see again and, like, sort of what their deal is. So, like, there's a lot of built-up stuff around this. Building toward this fight between Conquest and Battle Beast, two characters that we know both survive any sort of situation that they have here. So I was sort of like, I wish this was building towards something with slightly more stakes, perhaps, especially when the stakes of the series are Battle Beast is like, can someone please kill me? And we're like, well, no, we know that no one can kill you. So, like, I don't know. I guess I'm just feeling like,
well, let me,
you know too much.
Can I throw something out at you that I started to feel with this issue? Because we have talked about this all along, that, like, Battle Beast is very much a one-note character. He got a second note in this issue, which is the prince, who I'm blanking on the actual name of, is like, but we are friends, aren't we? And Battle Beast pauses for a second and says, yes. And there's that, like, little bit of movement of showing that maybe he does actually care about something else, which I do think is setting up when ultimately he and Conquest fight and probably destroy this whole planet, potentially killing his new friends or ruining his relationship with them. That might actually do something to him and push him in some direction.
And maybe it is like sort of like Battle Beast coming out of this depression, I would call it, and that's the point of the series. And if you're going to bring in a character to wantonly kill people that the other person he's fighting loves, that's what Conquest sort of does. That makes a little bit of sense. But I don't know. I guess we'll see, and maybe it will be about that. But it's really sneaking up on it when that's what we're getting in the 9th issue of this.
Star Trek, The Last Starship, number 7 from IDW, written by Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing, art by Herman Gonzalez. We're kicking off a new arc of this book as our last starship is traveling across the post-burn galaxy, desperately trying to bring people together. Unfortunately, nobody actually wants to be together. Complicating matters is there in a starship that for every, I'm forgetting the exact equation, basically like every week they travel is 7 years for the entire galaxy. So they're missing a lot. I think the clear indicator that they keep going with that is we probably are heading closer and closer to the Discovery timeline, the future timeline Discovery jumps into. But in this issue in particular, we're getting more about the mystery of why Kirk is back, what's going on with Agnes, who is the new Borg, who comes out of Star Trek Picard. I think generally we've all been enjoying this book, but how do you feel about this coming into the second arc with a new artist?
Why Kirky? Why Kirky? You keep saying Kirky on this episode of the stack.
Is
you
Kirky mean different things each time. Is Kirky a Smitty?
No. I think we're looping.
Cool cover.
Since when did this book become Event Horizon?
I don't
this
know.
This book is wildly dark and fucked up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The art
but
is
it's cool.
Really dark, too, in a cool way.
Yeah, I did prefer Adrian Bonilla, who did the first arc. I thought that was really lovely and matched the tone, but they are going for a more of a horror tone with this arc, so I'm willing to follow it.
The blacked out panels have a cool kind of space vibe to it, which I think works really well. Some really epic panels in here and epic art. The kind of face close up, like we get a little tease here in the cover, was insane.
Yeah, and like, is this universe going to be this way, or is this, as this title continues on, is it a dark exploration, or are we going to come out of it to a more Federation, a more classic Star Trek tone?
I don't know.
It'd be hard to come back from this.
I mean, we know. I don't think you guys watch, but we know where this ends up eventually with the Discovery timeline. I'm just curious. Yeah. We're like, how does this ship fit in? Because we are 7 years at a time getting closer and closer to that point. So we'll see. The Punisher, number 4 from Marvel, written by Benjamin Percy, art by Jose Luis Soares and Sergio De Villa. In this issue, after shooting himself in the head with some sort of brain scrambly thing, this issue, he is back to being the Punisher. The Punisher is back on the streets, and he is coming directly for Jigsaw. Now, we had Benjamin Percy on the live show this week, and he did talk about this book a little bit, so you can go and listen to that. But what do you guys think about this? Pete, you've been a little iffy about this run on Punisher. How do you feel about this issue now that Frank is back in merciless killing mode?
Yeah, this is great. It's great to see kind of Frank back in action. This kind of really sets up the Punisher versus Jigsaw. We also get some great face ripping, you know, just love a good, you know, ripping face off to reveal a villain underneath. Classic, nothing like a ripping little face. I think Punisher's, you know, doing the old dropping people from roofs move. And it's classic big pun there. So.
Why does Jigsaw want to wear Frank's face? It's not that much less.
Yeah, but think about it. If you're going to wear a face, wearing Frank's face would be an intimidating kind of move.
They have a similar face.
They do have a similar face. I have a related question about the faces. Is every time we see Jigsaw, it isn't like he's wearing these faces long term. It's like he cuts off somebody's face, puts it on his face, and then walks through a door, and it's like, ding dong, ha ha, I was wearing a fake face. Like, there's no delay. He does not keep them on for any amount of time.
I don't know how much fake facing you've done, Alex. But yeah, not much. It's hard to make it look
super convincing. It's hard to keep it looking. Yeah. It's hard to keep it fresh. So
it's like putting a piece of ham over your face and being like, ha-ha, I'll fool them all.
I'm a sandwich.
My ham face. Yeah. So, you got to line up the eye holes. It's very hard.
Yeah. I have another question, Pete. This one is for you. Is Microchip Punisher's Smitty, or is Foggy, or what's going
Maybe on? Maybe was, but not in this.
Yeah, what is my main feeling reading this book is, can you leave Microchip alone, please?
Agree. I like the Microchip-Frank relationship, I think, should be like begrudging collaborators. Because when this worked best back in the day, it was like Frank being like, I don't understand computers. I'm so mad I can't open a computer. And Microchip is like, I open computers all the time. Let me give you some information. He's the man in the chair for the Punisher. This, like, tortured relationship where he's, like, dropping him off the roof. And then, like, he's doing a little bit of Googling for him or whatever. I was like, I don't know. Like, I would rather not have it.
He's just so mean. Like, the amount of stuff that Frank is doing to Microchip is not commensurate to what Microchip did. Microchip, just to review, was like tortured by Kingpin and forced to implant a microchip, sure enough, in Frank's brain to force him to do Kingpin's dirty work. And Frank is like, I directly blame you, Microchip. I'm going to lock you in cages. I'm going to drop you off roofs. I'm going to torture you and threaten to kill you. You're never going to have sleep a second in your life at all.
It's fair.
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
Leave him alone.
No way, man.
Also, shouts to Microchip for being a regular hacker who somehow was able to cross the brain to computer interface with the Punisher and create a way to control him. He could be a billionaire inventor and surgeon, and instead he's like a sniveling wreck trying to escape the Punisher. And in the meantime, Google mapping things for this psychopath.
Let's talk about another psychopath, Deathstroke, the Terminator number 3 from DC Comics, written by Tony Fleece, art by Carmine Di Giandomenico. The cliffhanger for the second issue was that Deathstroke is fighting off against Bloodsport and Deadshot. Definitely
Deadshot and Deathblow.
Deathblow. Sorry about that.
That's the ultimate
Tony
joke here.
Kidding me?
Yeah. So the three of them are fighting because, as it turns out, by the end of the issue, everybody thinks that Deathstroke killed his friend Wintergreen. Obviously, he's being framed, maybe. But we also got a flashback to back in the day when Deathstroke and Wintergreen tried to set up their own League of Assassins, not realizing the League of Assassins would be kind of pissed about
that. They don't like that.
Which I thought was delightful. Seeing this meeting of the Assassins and then Ra's al Ghul shows up and is like, actually, very funny.
I know Assassins.
Yeah.
It was cool. And like, the idea of Deathstroke crossing over the Deathblow and Deadshot is so funny to me. But it's played so straight in this. It's like, no, this is very serious. I'm like, this is a punchline of a joke, technically.
But I like that they all have their own way of going about things. I think Tony Fleece captures their voices very differently. They have different action styles, thanks to Carmine Gian Domenico. And they're all sort of evenly matched, which I always think about like Deathstroke as the top of the food chain there. But seeing him on his back leg facing these guys was pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the twists and turns. The action is great. Art is fun. It's kind of cool to see these kind of characters versing against each other. So I think this is a fun idea and well executed.
I think the art is fantastic in this. It's so slick. Yeah, so cool.
The only problem I had was Wintergreen. I was like, that's kind of a weird name.
Oh. Too much like, especially when everyone has dead and death. And they're
yeah,
like,
do you prefer Bubblemint? Bubblemint?
Yeah, I was thinking Spearmint.
Spearmint.
Okay. And he uses a spear.
That's good.
That is good. We'll workshop it. Neighborhood Watch, number 2 from Boom Studios, written by Sarah Galley, art by Henning. This is one of my favorite books that is running right now. There was a great twist at the end of the first issue, which I am going to spoil, but before I do, I would highly recommend just read the first issue, going clean if you can, because there's some real nice surprises in there. But we are following two communities, one that's sort of like a crunchy granola-esque community, the other one that is very much like a high-end cul-de-sac, more rich
gated community,
exactly. And there is, we've been following two women who are leaders of the community who have been sleeping with another woman in the community. They end up finding a mysterious tunnel when she goes missing and find her shot in the center of that tunnel. And it turns out the woman that each of them was looking for is the same woman. And that's where we pick up this issue as the two of them start to realize, wait a second, she's been leading a double life. Why has she been leading a double life? And there are even more twists and turns that I didn't see coming this issue.
It's crazy to have a second book that's based on Mrs. Doubtfire.
Double Doubtfire. Yeah, I liked the way that they did it. They're like, okay, you describe her, I'll describe her, and then they both realize they're the same person. That was kind of a fun moment. I felt like I've seen that done differently, but the way that was kind of a fun realization for us and the characters at the same time. They kind of did a good job of showing instead of telling. But I like the twists and turns of this comic. I really like the art. It's got a great kind of vibe to it, and it creates a fun world.
I agree that this is a good mystery that they're building out, and the expansion of it has been very fun. Like you were saying, Alex, we get another relationship in here that I'm like, wait, how busy was this lady? That's too much.
Yeah, it's great. It's very hard to balance all this stuff and make them two compelling communities while having the mystery at the same time. So this is a really fun beginning for this book. Side-Dimensional Rivals, number 5 from Marvel by Peach Momoko, Elena Casagrande, Miguel Mercado, Natasha Bustos, Phil Noto, and Guri Hyrou. Now, this is about Psy, which is Peach Momoko's Ronin version of Psylocke, traveling through different dimensions to search for Infinity Stones. And each time she travels to a different dimension, we get a different artist is dealing with it. Here we travel back through those dimensions as we remember them page by page. And we also get a very cool mashup page just with all of those dimensions shattered, seeing them at the same time with different artists. Pete, you and I have talked about this before. This is just like a lovely book. Like, story-wise, sometimes it's hard to hold on to what Peach Momoko is doing. But I think it works here. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. And I had a blast reading this.
Yeah, artistically, what they're doing in this comic is really impressive. First off, cool cover. Yeah, I mean, this is super tight bananas art here. It's worth it for the art alone. That kind of like window pane smash thing, splash page that we get is just so amazing on many different levels. There's also some really cool pinup page. There's like a badass kind of ninja black and white page that was really fantastic. I just think artistically this is so much fun. Who cares if it makes sense or is anything, you know? So yeah, I'm just so blown away artistically. So it's fun.
Who cares if it makes sense? I mean, yeah, this is definitely a comic to pick up for the visuals because it doesn't quite, it's not meant to make sense. I think the characters in here are even like, this is a pretty crazy romp we just did. You're like, yep, it does feel yep. that way. But I will say the very last bit about the Infinity Stones and stuff I thought was cool.
Yeah.
And the art is nice.
Seventh Stone is a little butt stone, so that's adorable.
Yep. And it leaves it open for more. I would love to see a sequel series to this. We'll see. G.I. Joe, number 22 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Andrea Milana. In this issue, we are getting the introduction of Crystal Ball, a new baddie who seems to have mystical powers, but probably doesn't. He actually has energon powers, just like everybody else in this book. The Joe teams are after him anyway in his spooky haunted house. Pete, what'd you think about the introduction of Crystal Ball? Were you having a ball?
Yeah, I think this is a blast. I'm not familiar with the old Crystal Ball, but
I
think the back and forth between Destro and Cobra Commander was the sound of my childhood. So that was just such a youthful, fun thing to relive. But yeah, the old
you'd have your
dark
Destro
magic.
Destro and Cobra Commander would have sort of like. Sort of mean, like bitchy conversations.
Oh, with yeah,
other,
all the
like,
time.
Yeah, you know what? I shouldn't have gone there.
Yeah,
you
they're like, why the fuck did we retreat again? It's like, oh, you fucking try leading Destro. I'd love to. You know, so their back and forth is just fun.
And you were watching the version of G.I. Joe that aired at night on Showtime, right? With all the cursing.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah. You'd be watching The Real Housewives of Cobra Command.
Yeah, the
like,
Skinner X version.
Yeah, the Red Shoe Diaries, but it's Red Shoe, the G.I. Joe who wears red shoes.
Yes, and is being pretty sexual, but not really showing anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I do.
This Crystal Ball does feel like is this not a Joe from the past, Pete?
Not
How low
I know
on the tier?
Like, I think it is.
I would think it would have to be.
It would have to be, but I don't remember a Crystal Ball.
I guess it's
been after
maybe
my
a,
time.
After 3 years of the Energon universe, we have finally reached the limit of Pete's knowledge. That's pretty exciting.
I will say, Crystal Ball seems like a Joe or a Cobra person that they named pretty late in the process. They're like, Crystal Ball.
Yeah. Anyway, I continue to like this. I think Joshua Williamson is doing a nice, solid job of this title. Andrea Milana is great on the art, so it is a lot of fun. End of Life, number 4 from DC Vertigo, written by Kyle Starks, art by Steve Pugh. We are following an assassin who is hiding out in a small town with his dad, who is dying of cancer. A lot of big stuff goes down this issue as his dad faces off with an assassin who is after his son, while the son is forced very much against his will into a heroic situation that he may or may not survive. Man, every issue of this is so great, so funny, so real. Like dark emotional stuff happens this issue too, but this is excellent.
Well, just being great action sequences, great standoff in this. The art's excellent. This is really good.
Yeah, I love the grumpy old man standoff here. Impressive stash / facial hair on the hired killer. Great art. This is very cool. And the art really delivers on the tone of the book.
Just real quick before we move on, I do have some research on Crystal Ball.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Apologies to End of Life, but we did like the book. Crystal Ball, he may not be genetically or surgically enhanced, but he has managed to unsettle his Cobra cohorts by his mad behavior and tales of European mysticism.
European.
He is reputed to be the love child of a Romanian man with psychic powers and an American woman from Bangor, Maine. A Mainer.
Very specific. Fucking Mainer, dude. Jesus.
Well, I assume Mainer. that's a Stephen King reference, right?
Probably, but why?
Because spooky, scary. I guess.
Does it say what?
That's not enough.
Does it say what season he was created or when he came out in the?
Fall. I believe it's. I think it's from comic. G.I. Joe Special Missions number 24 of the comic.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. Got some reading to do, Pete. Let's Smile for the Camera, number 3 from IDW, written by Hannah Rose May, art by Mariana Puglia. We are following a bunch of fashion models who have been infected with the smile virus. It's picking them off one by one. Meanwhile, our main model that we're focusing has started to think it's actually the manager they're dealing with that is leading to their deaths, and there's a couple of journalists that want to look into it. It's not. It's the smile entity, so that's going to end up pretty bad for them. But what do you guys think about this? I think we've been generally positive about the series so far.
I like it. It's a simple story that just really goes hard. We have the horror elements. There's a sense of impending doom always, but it doesn't feel predictable by any means.
Yeah, this is a big nope for me just because it's so fucking creepy. That smile shit, it freaks me the fuck out, man. Art is great, but yeah, that face crunch where just smashing the face into the mirror and then the smile afterwards, just it's just.
How do you look in the mirror in the morning?
I don't do a face crunch. I'd say that much. Right. Yeah,
not a face crunch.
Yeah,
not,
my not wife is crunch, so yeah. sick of replacing our mirror and my face.
Yeah, that's a lot of bad luck.
Lobo, number 3 from DC Comics, written by Scotty Young, art by Jorge Corona and Nicoletta Baldari. This is an issue that Scotty Young told us about when he was on our live show, so you can go back and listen to him talking about it. But Lobo tells a story from back when he was a kid meeting space dolphins for the first time, so we get a guest artist popping in for that. Pete, you're our main man on The Main Man. What'd you think about this issue?
Yeah, fun cover. Fun Lobo as a kid here. Yeah, I just think that, I enjoy the silliness. The art brings a nice tone that supports this kind of silliness. And you won't believe it. Lobo was an asshole as a kid, too. You don't say. So, yeah, I think they're just having fun with this. And it feels like it's jumping off right through their brain in this issue.
Scotty talks about how great the Nicoletta Baldari art was here, and it really paid off. It was a nice, fun departure, very much in the world without really feeling like it was a fill-in. He talked about how it wasn't necessary. They had to have another artist come in, and they really seamlessly played it into the story. Fun stuff.
Yeah. And Scotty does know.
Scotty does know. And that is it for the stack. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to YouTube.
Sure do.
Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books, Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, follow the show, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, remember, you're a Smitty or a Foggy, but a Foggy is a Smitty.
Oh,
my brain. The microchip put a chip in my brain, and now I'm broken.
And they let the secrets leak. And occasionally